We should go ahead and get going. Thank you for coming out and braving the ice and the snow. And it's supposed to snow while we're in here. That's what I heard. Just kidding. Cheryl thought it was serious. See, that was my joke. Now, thanks for coming out. And tonight we're going to get into a period of time that's of great importance to the Christian church. And we went to a speech class today at the church, the homeschool group, and it was the Christian Reformed Church. And tonight and next Wednesday, when we talk about this, you're going to know where that comes from, because they come directly out of the Reformation. The Reformation is when the modern face of Christianity is really painted in, at least Protestant Christianity for sure. So we want to talk about this great moment in the history of Christianity tonight, and I've got a couple film clips to show that I think are really great illustrations of some of the themes, and so hopefully it'll be good. Let's begin with prayer, though. Okay, well let's talk about the Protestant Reformation. One of the great upheavals of the Christian world, and not just the Christian world, but the Western world, is this Reformation of the 16th century. And what happened in the 16th century was that sweeping changes took place in the church. All throughout the Middle Ages, there was essentially one institution known as the church in the Middle Ages. And you got on board with that, or you might be burned alive. I mean, that happened. We didn't talk about that, but I could show you pictures if you want, or drawings of that. And I've actually got a good film that shows somebody being burned alive, what it might have looked like. And it's horrible, but it happened, you know. And so there was this emphasis on everybody being on the same page. And what happens in the Reformation is that there's this break that takes place, a major split. And it was a split of the church. But as Luther said, this young man who's pictured up here, he said, sometimes a split is necessary when something like the gospel is at stake. And they believe that something critical is at stake. That is, how is a person saved? Are you saved by works and all that you can do, or is it a free gift of God? And that's the heart of what the Reformation was about. But some causes of the Reformation. Why did this thing happen? Why did it happen in the 16th century? And I want to point to just a few. One of them is superstition. On the eve of the 16th century, the church is a very, very superstitious place. People are seeing, you know, demons everywhere. There's all kinds of leftovers from the pagan past, Germanic pagan customs, even Greco-Roman paganism that has been engrafted into Christianity. And then on top of that is all kinds of other customs. And the average person is a very superstitious type of person. We talked briefly last week about relics, and here are a couple relics. I think we have here the bones of one of the saints on the right side, and then, of course, on the left is one of the many, you know, shrouds that, you know, has the face of Jesus on it, and this has some power in it. It's a very scary world in which people are looking for ways to protect themselves from the demonic powers and so forth, and relics. Things that connected them with holy people of the past were given a special power and seemed to have very miraculous abilities. And you wanted to collect as many as you could. Frederick the Wise, Luther's prince, actually, in the 16th century, prided himself on having one of the best relic collections in Europe. 17,000 true relics, verified relics in his collection. And if you've ever seen the movie Luther that came out a few years ago, there's a great scene that shows him kind of walking through there and pointing out all these beautiful relics. And, of course, his university professor that launches the Reformation says, it's all that stuff. And so it's like, it would be like collecting gold coins all your life, and then all of a sudden you realize they're not worth anything, right? And so there's a lot of superstition that has to do with these relics. Mark Twain made the quip back in the late 19th century that there were enough splinters of the cross in Europe to shingle a barn. You've heard that one, okay? And the true cross, right? So Dan, you had a point. You were,
I was going to say that verification of relics was a process, but many things were verified that were highly questionable. You mentioned a couple last week, we mentioned a couple of weeks before,
right,
like vials containing Mary's milk, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Not likely. There were six eggs of John the Baptist.
Right.
There are today, then there were 18 or something. But
right.
Never down to six anyway.
Right. So you have things like this, and that even Catholics will acknowledge it was there was a lot of things that were way off base. Okay, and Catholics today will say yes, there was a lot of superstition, and even in the 16th century they would say yeah, there was a lot of superstition, a lot of that stuff needs to be cleaned up. Okay, but also there was corruption, lots of corruption in the church. Oh. Can you go back on the slide? I went ahead of myself. Corruption in the church leadership. And I made a little comment in my sermon this past Sunday about the fact that, you know, you show me a time where there's corruption in the church, I'll show you a time when this is the leaders that are corrupt. And from the very top all the way down to the parish priest, you could find lots of corruption in the church. Here we have two popes of the late Middle Ages that were especially known for their corruption. Alexander VI was known for his sexual deviancy. The saying was that he had even propositioned one of his own daughters for sexual favors. And if you think about that, you know, he's supposed to be a celibate priest, right? And so he's got a daughter and then he's propositioned. So it's just really bad. And that's where this little woodcut comes from. This is kind of like a little piece of paper that people would pass around to criticize the Pope. And, oh, here's a picture of Pope Alexander VI, and he looks all nice. And then you open it up and it says, Ego sum Papa, I am the Pope, you know, and it's a demon from hell, right? So on one side, it looks like the Pope, he's all holy, holy, and then you open it up, and I'm your daddy, you know, I'm the devil, basically. And so it's a very, they were aware of this corruption at the time. On the right side, we have Julius II, actually, who was Pope from 1503 to 1513, known as the Warrior Pope. I mentioned, I think last week, in the clip from the film, we saw when Luther comes to Rome, and they say, here comes the Pope, and he's riding in on a horse. That's Julius II. And he was well known for his, he didn't really care about spiritual things. All he cared about was controlling the lands that the papacy had. And they had a swath of land in the middle of Italy that was known as the Papal States. And it was like his own little government. And he would actually go to war with other Italian states. Okay? And he loved to wear armor and go out and fight in battle. And many of the more sensitive spiritual leaders of the time were just very critical of this. And in fact, when he died, the great Renaissance humanist, Christian humanist Erasmus, wrote a little pamphlet called Julius Excluded from Heaven. And it's a funny story of a dialogue. It's kind of one of those, when you get to the gates of heaven, St. Peter says, it's one of those stories. And Julius comes up to the gates of heaven, and it opens up with describing him going like this. It's like, oh, I know one of these keys should work. You know, I've got the keys to the kingdom, right? That's what the Pope has, supposedly. He's trying, but none of them works. And then the scene cuts to the top of the ramparts of the kingdom of heaven, and Peter and I think it's Paul or somebody are walking around on the gates, and Peter says, what's that foul stench that I smell? And they look down and there's the Pope, right? And so there's this dialogue that happens between Peter and Julius, and Peter says, okay, your key doesn't work, but okay, tell me why you should get into heaven. Tell me all the good works you did. Oh, I didn't have any time for that. I was too busy defending the church and making more money for the church. And okay, well, how about other things that you did? Did you pray a lot? Oh, I had no time for that, you know? And so he just kind of goes to this interesting dialogue, and at the end of the day, Peter says, sorry, you can't get into heaven. And that's the Pope, who is supposed to be the top of the church. So there's lots of corruption from the very top all the way down to the bottom. You know, the average, even priest, would sometimes be, often be not very devoted to his job. On the bishop level and even lower level, we had a rampant problem with simony. Anybody know what simony is? You ever heard of that word? Remember Simon in Acts 8? What did he try to do? He tried to buy the Holy Spirit. Okay? And ever since the early church, it was considered a sin to try to buy a church office. You know, and I know it's kind of weird to think about this today, you know, but just imagine if somebody, you know, like when you're looking for a preacher, they come in and say, well, I'd like to be your preacher and I'll give you $10,000 right now for the position. I mean, we can't even imagine that, right? Because it's kind of like, well, the other way around. Why would somebody want to purchase a church office?
It was the
power. Anything else besides power? Okay.
If your son or daughter has a higher ranking position in the church, that assures you bypassing purgatory.
Okay, yeah.
Things that you can do.
Some spiritual benefits, but let's think more mundane. How about this? Okay. With Charlemagne back in the 9th century, he said he instituted the tithing. 10% was the law. You had to tithe to the church. And that money went to the, you know, the church, right? But the bishop was administering those funds, and a lot of times they would pilfer those funds. And so it was a very lucrative position. I mean, just imagine, you know, if you had a diocese that you were in charge of, and the church actually owns hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres that are being worked by serfs, and there's revenue coming from that, and you're in charge of that. So this was involved. And so people would buy church offices. In fact, on the eve of the Reformation, the Archbishop of Mainz had purchased his archbishopric. Because it was, you know, not just a bishop, but an archbishop high up there. Lots of money. And he broke several church laws to do that, simony. But he also wasn't 30. You're supposed to be 30 to be a bishop. So that was when he broke, too. Okay? And so he broke several. And in order to pay, it gets really convoluted here, but follow me here. In order to get that money, well, let's see. He took out a loan from a bank, the Fugger Bank, F-U-G-G-E-R. Okay? And in order to secure that loan, he got an agreement from the Pope that he could then sell indulgences. And half of the revenue from the indulgences would go to pay back that loan, and the other half would go to build St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. You got it? So there's all kinds of corruption that's right in this time period. We'll talk about indulgences here in a minute. But simony was a major problem, and it's always been a sin in the church, but it was just kind of winked at. And multiple offices. This is when you would have a bishop who was the bishop of Lorraine, or the bishop of Cologne, and the bishop of Reims, and the bishop of these other places. They would collect these bishoprics. They could not be there to shepherd the flock. And again, why would they do that? Because they receive the revenues from those positions. It would be like me being a preacher at 5 different churches and collecting the salary from each of them, but only getting to preach at one every Sunday. Okay? There's an interesting quote from a bishop in the late Middle Ages that illustrates this kind of corruption. He said something to the effect that being the Archbishop of Reims would be a great job if you didn't have to sing the Mass. Okay? Which means, that would be like me saying, hey, being a preacher is a great job if I didn't have to preach sermons. You know, because of how lucrative it was. Okay. And then lastly, ignorant priests. There were many on the local level, you would have priests, many of whom could only say the Mass. They didn't even know what it meant. Okay. They spout the Latin. They learned the rote phrases. But they really couldn't minister. They couldn't help people spiritually. And of course, there always is a spiritual longing in the church. Okay. Yes.
You mentioned the Fugger Bank. There's also Medici.
Medici, yeah.
And they, between the two of them, I got the impression that they could actually dictate church law because so many church officials owe them money for their church.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. If they're in hawk.
The you know, banks that were determining what church law would be.
They could influence, yeah, heavily.
How
yeah.
Is there any reasonable estimate about how common the sexual immorality was?
I would have to get some specific numbers, but here's what can help you understand how common it was. In some dioceses, there was a set amount that you paid the bishop if you were a priest that had a concubine. I mean, they had a set price. So, I mean, if they've actually haggled on a price and said, okay, if you're going to have a concubine, you can't marry her, obviously, but if you're going to have a concubine, this is how much you have to pay the bishop. So that tells you it's pretty common. Pretty common. And, you know, and see, the average person knows. They see this and oh, the priest's cousin has come to live with him. And his nieces and nephews are show up, you know, out of nowhere, you know, and they're his own children, basically, and the people know this, and it doesn't help the value that people are placing on the priests. There's a very strong anti-clerical movement in the late Middle Ages, meaning opposition to the priesthood, and some of it's because they're ignorant and they're immoral, and we still have to pay them 10%, and it really stinks, and people are unhappy with this. Yeah, it's the government, like the government. Oh, okay. Don't start us down that road now. It really. Yes.
Could you say a little bit more about the connection between the church and the government during this time? But they were somehow interlocked.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't quite understand.
Yeah. Technically, they're not the same. I mean, you have the theory was the two swords. You have the spiritual sword, and then you have the temporal sword. And both are functioning under God's reign. They both have a job to do. And a priest would never wield the sword. He would never go out and enforce the law. He would say to the princes, that's your job. Okay, so there was a distinction. A priest could not go out and do that kind of thing. But what they would do is heavily influence legislation or what the prince would do. Every prince had an advisor, a confessor, that he would take advice from. Based on what the church believed and what was right and what was wrong. And every good Christian prince wanted to rule in a way that pleased God and that held together this concept of Christendom, that everybody in your society is a Christian and we're going to make our laws almost synonymous with the Christian law, even though technically they knew that there was a distinction. And so it's really like two sides of the same coin. And there's a great scene, we're going to watch it here in a little bit, I think, when we get to it, that shows that at the Diet of Worms, which is a secular meeting, a secular council of the Holy Roman Empire. You have the seven electors there and the emperor sitting there. But right next to him is a cardinal who's going to be advising him. And that's a good image. The state actually has the power, but they're acting on the strong advice of the spiritual power.
Was there an economic connection between the church and the state?
You mean like flowing money flowing back and forth between treasuries?
Buy each other or buy things off?
Yeah, I mean, that could happen, and it did.
The church owned property that was within a state.
Right.
Yet they considered themselves somehow independent. Did one pay taxes? Did the emperor have to pay taxes to the church?
Now you're getting me. You're pulling me back into the late Middle Ages, which is, I skipped some things, and that's what you're getting to. There was a huge fight over this in the High Middle Ages. You've maybe heard of Gregory VII, Hildebrand, the Pope who fought against Henry of the Holy Roman Empire, and they had a big fight over this because the secular princes were appointing bishops and appointing archbishops, and Gregory said, no way, you can't do that. And they got in a big fight over it, and at the end of the day, the secular prince was allowed to appoint a bishop, but the Pope could veto that, and that was the compromise they came to. Later on, some of the secular princes, King of France, for example, wanted to get out from having to pay taxes, or wanted to tax church property within France. The church said no way to that, excommunicated him, he marched down there, kicked the Pope off. I mean, they fought over this in the Middle Ages. It wasn't like the princes all just said, "Oh, you're the spiritual power." So.
Yeah, so when Luther made his break, there were a lot of people willing to.
Exactly, and that's a good point. There were some who, on the political side, said, "Hey, this would be a good way to break away from the church's control." Especially the Germans didn't like the Italian Pope, you know, telling them what to do. Rex, you had your hand up there. Exactly. Yeah, and that's something that, you know, modern scholars are more and more becoming aware of is the spiritual power that the church really did play on people. You know, it's easy for modern secular historians especially to say, well, yeah, they were really motivated by secular ideas. But the more we read the sources, the more we realize, no, these princes really did fear for their souls. They really did, were afraid. Let me give you an example. The Battle of Hastings, 1066. I read a book last year about this. I thought it was really fascinating. When the Duke of Normandy, William the Conqueror, comes across the English Channel and he conquers the English. Right before the Battle of Hastings, I'm blanking on the name of the king, Edward, the English king, who was defending his kingdom against this French conqueror. A letter came from the Pope to him. He was ready to defend himself and had a stronger army. Came to him and said, "You have been excommunicated from the church, and everyone in your kingdom cannot take Mass, and you will go to hell, and if you die outside the church, you know, blah, blah, blah." And he totally lost his nerve. He totally lost it and couldn't function because he was afraid for his soul. Okay? And he lost it, and the rest literally is history. The English lost, and the Normans conquered England. And you could point to that over and over again, that they really did care about their soul. You guys have heard of usury, right? Okay, it was a sin in Christian Europe in the Middle Ages to charge another Christian interest, you know, based on the Old Testament law, Leviticus. But a lot of times they got around that, especially those Venetian merchants, you know, they would find some way, they would buy the goods in Florentine money, and then change the money over into money that's used in Milan or something like that, you know. And in the exchange rate, they got their interest, okay? But I went to a conference a few years ago where a guy did a paper on the wills of these merchants. And they left money in their wills for priests or monks to pray for them just in case they had broken these usury laws, okay? So even those greedy businessmen, they were breaking the... And they tried to make sure they did, but just in case I did, I want some people to pray for me. So they put that in their will, okay? Which the guy was like, man, these guys really did care about their souls. I was like, duh, you know?
Yeah. When Jesus heals a lame man at the pool of Siloam, mm-hmm. He's kicked out of the synagogue because he won't denounce Jesus.
Okay.
That's a similar kind of power that the church has.
Right, yeah. And, you know, they did have it, and you know, because people didn't doubt the spiritual realm, they didn't doubt there was an afterlife, and they didn't doubt that the church played some role in where you spent that afterlife. So... Okay, kind of got off there, but that's all right. We covered some things that we should have covered before anyway, and hopefully it was beneficial. But on the local level, there's a lot of corruption running through this, and people feel this, and there are calls for reformation. But there's also this major theological abuse that has to do with indulgences. And I think we talked about that last week a little bit. But just in case you weren't here, let me give you the shortened version of that. And that is that ever since the High Middle Ages, the church had taught that there was basically a treasury of merit. You might call it a bank account, a spiritual bank account. That extra good works of Mary and Jesus and other saints, that more than what they needed to go to heaven, were kind of put into this. And that you could access this. The Pope could access this. So take this merit here and apply it over here. Okay? And it was known as an indulgence. And so originally it was used to help the Crusaders who died in battle, to ensure them that they would be forgiven of their sins. Plenary indulgence, meaning a full indulgence. But then other times it would be used to help people during difficult times. And then right on the eve of the Reformation, it is done to help build St. Peter's Basilica. Okay, the one that... So have any of you been to St. Peter's Basilica? I haven't been there, but any of you guys been there? I've been there in my mind several times. But it's a beautiful place, but it was built on indulgence money. Okay, people who bought indulgences to cover them from sins and to pay and help someone who was already in purgatory, languishing in purgatory, help them get out of purgatory. And on the eve of the Reformation, the infamous Johann Tetzel, who was just a priest going around doing what he was supposed to do under the commission of the Archbishop of Mainz, the guy that had purchased the office, right, to sell these indulgences to pay back this loan. And there was a phrase that he used, as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, right then and there the soul from purgatory springs. Okay, that little jingle. Kind of like George Moreland, tell me, you know? You kind of got it on your tongue now, right? So, and people, you know, the average ignorant peasant out there, that's all they, oh yeah, if I put that in there, then I can help out my uncle and aunt, I can help out my own life. And this is a scene, we're going to show a scene right here from the movie Luther that I think is one of the best, I don't know of a better illustration of what this was and why it made Luther so upset. So Bob's going to show us this little clip and then we'll move on. Tetzel was as dramatic as
don't unfurl the banners until the fire ignites. Everything has been prepared. Nothing has been expected. Good people of Uteberg, have you ever burned your hand in the fire? Even one finger made raw by the flame will torment you throughout the night. Is it not so?
Yes!
Imagine then, your entire body burning. Not for one sleepless night, not for a week, but for all eternity. Are we to be spared the fires of damnation on the judgment day? Tonight, your Pope, the Vicar of Christ, sends you a gift to save you from such fires. A special indulgence granted for the building of St. Peter's Church in Rome, where the bones of the apostles lie mouldering, exposed to wind and rain, desecrated by wild animals. Take heed the words of your Holy Father who says, lay a stone for St. Peter's, and you lay the foundation for your own salvation and happiness in heaven. How? With this indulgence. When? Tonight, and only tonight. Seek the Lord while he is near. Here is your raft. Take hold.
In heaven there
there is a treasure chest filled with merit. Merit from Christ Jesus, the Virgin Mary, and the saints who, through their holy lives, have merit to spare for us poor sinners in need. Tonight that treasury is open to you. Do you not hear their voices? The screaming voices. Your deceased parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts, screaming, beloved child, because for a few coins, you can rescue them from their punishments and pain. Listen, open your ears. Father calling to son, mother to daughter. When a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. God-fearing man, do you have a coin for Christ?
Yes.
Certain your crippled child can run to Jesus. These learned monks are standing by to write down your name or the name of a loved one, dead or alive, on this, your passport to the celestial joys of paradise.
So,
you're working on a phrase, are you?
I'm sorry?
Are you working on a jingle? Or?
Yeah. We should come up with one. Yeah. Yeah. Now, whenever I see that scene, I do think of that was the PowerPoint of the 16th century, you know, slap down the things, and, you know, and so forth. I mean, it is true. I mean, just imagine those people are illiterate. They cannot read the Bible. They cannot just go and, well, is there anything about a treasure of merit in the Bible? They can't do that. Okay, they're completely under the control of these. Notice what he said, learned monks. They'll write down your name. I mean, you can only mark X, but they can write down your name, and that will go to the Pope and all that. So there's a lot of control that the clerics have over the average person. So you see, this is what Luther got so mad about. In this next scene, it shows her kind of coming in. They couldn't sell this in Saxony, which is where Luther was, okay? But right across the state line, so to speak, is where this sale was going on. It was within the Albrecht of Mainz territory. And so people from Luther's church were going over there, and you know, it'd be like some big preacher coming to town, everybody going over there to hear the big preacher, and then they come back and say, well, hey, guess what? I go to heaven, you know? Woohoo! And Luther sees this girl, and he hears what's going on over there. He tells her it's worth nothing, and then he gets all upset, and he posts his 95 theses as to why indulgences are not right. Okay? Which launches the Reformation. Okay, and by the way, this down what you see here on the... this is actually one of the thing that would have been at the bottom of that indulgence. This is the papal seal. You see the keys? That's the keys of the kingdom, right? He has the ability to open up that treasury of merit. And then it talks about, you know, this is given completely. Rex could probably read the whole thing for us. But anyway, but his name is there, Johannes Tetzel. Okay.
Did he believe?
Yeah.
When he was talking and preaching, did he
Absolutely. I mean, it was taught and believed there is a treasure of merit. And if I remember correctly, I went and looked this up at the Catholic Encyclopedia. They still hold to that. It's probably not what is preached. You know, that's like one of those things, you know, crazy uncle. You don't talk about him very often, you know. But it still is part of church doctrine, you know, and that the Pope can grant an indulgence. Now, the Catholic Church today would say that was an abuse. And Tetzel, by the way, at the time was condemned for some of his hyperbole. Remember we talked about hyperbole a few weeks ago? He got a little bit upset, and when people began to doubt that the indulgences were effective, he started to say things like, with this indulgence, you could rape the very mother of Christ, and this indulgence would take care of the sin. And you talk about going over the top, right? The Virgin Mary. And he got in trouble for that one, but he did believe it. He did believe it. And so Luther challenges this, and I'm kind of getting ahead of myself because I didn't want to talk about the 95 Theses right now, but he challenges, does this really exist? And if it does exist, why doesn't the Pope just open it up? And just, like, dump the whole thing out on all of us for no money at all? He asked some good questions. It's 95 questions about the indulgences, is what the 95 Theses is. Okay, now we wouldn't want to talk about Luther until we've also talked about some of the things that came... I can't tell what's coming next. So, before Luther, to kind of prepare the way, when Luther posts the 95 Theses, there's already a whole network of people, learned people, who are longing for spiritual reform that are ready for it. It's like, and then when he starts this thing, it's like there's already kindling there. He puts the spark. And the spark comes from Renaissance humanism. One of the great preparations for the Reformation would be the Renaissance, which, as you guys all remember from high school or college or whatever, it was a revival of learning after kind of this downswing in the Middle Ages that comes back in the 15th century. But one of the big emphases of Renaissance was emphasis upon ancient values and ancient literature, and that it is better than the modern literature. They had a phrase that they used the word modern as a pejorative. You know, anything modern. Oh, modern stuff. We want the old stuff is better. The old is better. The old authors, the ancient literature teaches us truth. This medieval stuff is no good. And one of the phrases of the Renaissance humanists, and especially those who were wanting to reform the church, was go back to the sources. In the Latin phrase, ad fontes, go back to the sources, and there you will find pure waters, whether it's pure waters of Greek and Roman philosophy that were untainted by this German barbarian learning that's not really learning, or go back to those sources of the early Christian church, and there you'll find clear, crystal clear theology. And so when it comes to reforming the church, this phrase, go back to the sources, is huge. And that's why I am personally, when I stumbled on to the Christian humanist movement and Erasmus particularly on the right there, we really resonate with that. This is a back to the Bible movement. And these guys really emphasize going back to the Bible, seeing what the Bible says, and exploring its themes rather than all of the stuff that's accumulated over the Middle Ages. This guy on the right, Erasmus of Rotterdam, was the greatest Christian humanist of the time period. He did probably more than any other single person, I think it's fair to say, to help create a biblical culture that was ready to receive what Luther had to bring. Okay, and one of the ways that he did that was to publish the first printed edition of the New Testament in Greek. Okay. Now, what's unique about that, based on what we remember?
Sorry? They only had Latin.
Okay, yeah.
No studying the original, they only had Latin.
Right.
400, 500.
Yeah, they did have printed editions of the Latin Vulgate, but not the Greek. If you wanted to read Greek manuscripts, you had to go to a monastery someplace and pull out a Greek manuscript. Okay, so what he does here is he publishes this book that has on one side the Latin Vulgate, and then on the other side the actual Greek from the manuscripts. so that people who had recently, the Renaissance also emphasized learning Greek and Hebrew and good Latin, and then you could read the Bible in the original, not just read the Bible in a translation, but read it in its original. And when they did that, all of a sudden they start seeing some things that undermine the medieval Catholic Church. Okay? Well, one example is the word penance. Remember, one of the seven sacraments is penance. And then, but in the Greek, you find out there is no word penitentia. It's not one word. It's just the word metanoia, noeo, which means to have a change of mind, to if you're going that way, go this way. It doesn't mean do a physical thing, which in the Latin, that's what that word had been translated and interpreted to mean for 500, 600 years. And it was one of the seven sacraments. But these guys read the Greek and they say, repentance doesn't mean anything about going and doing a work of satisfaction. It means changing your life. So this begins to undermine things, okay? Things like, Hail Mary, full of grace, okay? Remember that? Ave Maria, right? They realize the word gratia there for grace doesn't mean she's full of grace, meaning she can dispense grace to you. You pray to her, she'll dispense grace. Grace just means favor. Hey, God's on your side. It doesn't mean that it's the grace that she can then hand over to you. So you can see how studying the original languages also undermines some stuff of the Catholic teaching. And Erasmus, although he never left the Roman Catholic Church, sure did a lot of things that helped, I believe. The humanists definitely picked up his stuff and went with it, those who became reformers. So, and also, I would point out that this is a, you have the, yeah, Greek on this side, Latin on this side. And I can't remember which book this is. But then at the end of each book, it would have notes, kind of like modern commentaries. And critical notes like geography and things that we're familiar with in our study Bibles, he starts doing that. And this becomes a standard thing. And this is way back in the 16th century. No, not this. Now, he would be highly criticized. And he always had to write and defend things that he had stated in his annotations. Okay. Now.
But this wasn't probably circulated.
No, not the masses, but the learned scholars out there that could read Greek. I mean, this just went like wildfire amongst them. And they would turn around then and start preaching different kinds of sermons. Okay. One interesting thing, this kind of gets us into textual criticism a little bit, but since you brought it up, Tom, he did get criticized heavily for... in the Latin Vulgate, I'm trying to remember, it's in the book of 1 John, chapter 4, where it says there are three who testify, Spirit, the water, and the blood, right? Okay. In the Latin, it makes it much more clear that this is the Trinity. In the Greek, there's a phrase that's missing there. And there, he couldn't find any Greek manuscripts that had that phrase, so he left it out. And so this monk highly criticized him and said, you don't believe in the Trinity, you left out this very important passage. And he said, it's not in any of the Greek manuscripts, it's in the Latin manuscripts, so I left it in the Latin, but I didn't put it in the Greek. And they fought over it and wrote back and forth and blah, blah, blah. And Erasmus finally says, okay, fair enough. If you can find me one Greek manuscript where this phrase is in, I will include it in my next edition. So he gets a letter in the mail. He gets a letter in the mail. It's a Greek manuscript. And this monk. It's a Greek manuscript. And you know how sometimes, and then you, that? And he wrote it in Greek right there. And so Erasmus, he put it in his next edition, but he put a footnote and said, I highly suspect that this is not original, and so-and-so, blah, 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 and this and that, and, but guess what? It got into the textual tradition, and it's in the King James translation, even though there's no Greek manuscripts for that. So, anyway, different story. Maybe we'll cover that some other time when we talk about the history of the Bible. But, anyway, he was a great scholar, and that's why I got a picture of him in my office there, so if you want to see more. Okay, So he is one of the precursors, but Luther comes along and he really will launch this thing. And what here's what I would like to say about the Reformation before we stop for tonight. At least the cause of the Reformation. You will misunderstand the Reformation if you think it was just a matter of kind of cleaning up some of the abuses. The simony, the multiple offices, priests that have concubines, those kinds of things. The Reformers will clean up those things, but it wasn't just about those things. And after the Catholics will actually say, yeah, we should clean up those things too. Okay? But Luther is very clear, that's not the heart of what I'm after. He believed that the medieval theology, the sacramental theology that we talked about, was rotten to the core. It needed to be trimmed way down. You know, just imagine a tree that's rotten. He said, you got to cut that thing down. And all the Reformers believed that. Now, they disagreed on how far you go down. Like, there were some that said, let's get out the stump grinder and just, you know, do that. And Luther wouldn't go that far. He said there was still Christianity in the medieval church. It was just covered up by all kinds of layers of junk when you get rid of that stuff. Okay? And he believed that the main issue is salvation by faith alone. You're not saved by anything that you do. You make zero contribution to your salvation. Okay? Whereas the church in the Middle Ages says, no, grace, God gives His grace, but He expects you to do works. If you don't do works, you will not go to heaven. And so they very explicitly said, your works count towards your salvation. And even after the Reformation, the Council of Trent, they said, absolutely, works count towards your salvation, period. Okay? And Luther would say, no. The Romans and Galatians teach there's absolutely nothing you can do. Okay? He would even go as far to say that the faith that you have is actually not your faith. It has to be given to you by God. Okay? So even the fact that you can say, I believe in Jesus, was something that was given to you as a gift. Okay? So that's what I want you to chew on for next week, because we're going to unpack what that means. It's a pretty radical view. It's more radical than I think most evangelicals even today think, right, or understand. Okay? It's radical. And he's pretty insistent about it. Okay? Okay, any questions about that before we got like 30 seconds left? Yeah, Tom.
You talked about the cause of the Reformation. Maybe enable is a better word, but the printing press has a lot to do. Because without that, then all this talk and this information doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, so, you know, 67 years before Luther's 95 Theses, Gutenberg's press comes out in 1450 and creates...
What has advanced civilization in the last 1,000 years? The printing press is about head and shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Good point. Yeah. It is hard to imagine the Reformation taking place without it. Just because, Luther, give you an example. He posts his 95 Theses, and then a bunch of guys come and steal it, and they take it to a printing press, and they... and they send it all out. And next thing you know, he's like, you know, everybody all around knows about what I wrote. And when he originally wrote it, he wrote it in Latin, not German. And it was going to be a scholarly discussion. It was going to be a university discussion among scholars. And these guys said, no, we're taking that thing. And they sent it all throughout Germany like that. And so that's a good example of how it happened, you know. And the printing press just made it so much easier to communicate. So... and then after the Reformation gets going, people, if it's cheaper to have books, then more people will have incentive to read, and therefore they can read the Bible. Okay. So Christianity becomes a literate culture again, after it's been illiterate for a long time. All right, so you see why I think this is good stuff. Now, and I hope that, here's my hope and my prayer, that that you can appreciate the Reformation on its own merits, okay? What you've heard about Luther and Calvin, we're going to criticize them at the end, okay? But I want you to appreciate what they did at the time, okay? You need to. I need to. And so, suspend your judgment for a little bit and enjoy learning what they did or reviewing what they did. So, Okay, thanks for your attention, and we'll pick up next week with this.